Hey folks, Rob Wolf here with Greg Everett. It's episode 91. It's not early in the morning, but it feels early in the morning, at least to me.
It pretty much always feels early until about 1 or 2 for me.
And then it just feels late.
I'm just worn down from the day. So.
I have a 15-minute window in which I feel really optimized.
Yes.
I'm either lagging or crashing, one or the other. So what's new with you, dude?
Oh, man, not a whole lot. Going to build some new polling blocks today, hopefully, if I'm feeling ambitious, and that's about it.
Sweet. I have no such ambitions. I'm just working on some articles about performance, health, and longevity and all that silly hookadook. So,
well, that's way harder than building stuff.
Not if you have my skill set with building things.
Oh, well, good point.
I would end up with two fingers and a lot of ruined wood. So,
All right. Well,
since we're super fired up, I guess we'll just jump in on this.
How's life post public seminars for you?
Are you psyched? You know, we still have one more seminar to do, but it's good. Like, we've got some forward momentum on the CME offerings that we're trying to put together. It's just a really long, really expensive process to jump through all these you know, silly physician-oriented medical education offerings, but just basically chipping away at it. You know, it could be a full-time job just trying to get that stuff done, but just have to take an hour or two here and there in between doing everything else. So we have one person who's kind of focused on that as her primary gig, getting that thing going, but then I have some input as well. Nikki's working with a couple of dudes from the original Expedia founding members on a business management software package, and that looks pretty interesting. So we'll be talking to folks a little bit about that. Keystone is clawing at my feet right now because he wants attention, and that's pretty much my life.
Wow.
Yep.
Got a lot going on.
It's a complex scenario, and I really don't deal with complexity very well. I'm kind of, you know, the multitasking deal I fail on pretty epically, so.
Yeah, that is definitely not my strong suit.
Indeed. Women are better at multitasking. I'm absolutely sold on that one.
It's true. When I worked for the ambulance company, I used to pick up dispatch shifts every once in a while for extra money. And by and large, the male dispatchers were terrible, me included. And the female ones were, like, totally calm, composed, handling, like, 6 calls at once. We would get 2 calls at once, and it's just the world would fall apart.
Yeah, we're just good at killing stuff and fighting and like scratching ourselves. I think that's where we really shine.
Yes, I know I do.
And then women are good at other stuff.
Yes.
So with that preamble, maybe we should get going.
We should probably get going before we dig ourselves a deeper hole.
Sweet.
Justin says, hi, Rob and Greg. Before going paleo, I was a bug magnet every time I went outside during the summer. This year, after going paleo, I regularly go hiking with my non-paleo friends. How can you have non-paleo friends, Justin?
I don't know. The orthodox paleoites will definitely bounce this dude out real soon.
And while they complain about the bugs and are swatting constantly, I have gone without bug spray and not really been bothered. After trying some low-carb paleo for the last month or so and entering ketosis, I have been practically immune to the critters, and it got me wondering. Google didn't lead to much, but it did lead to this study, and Justin has a link which we will include, which showed that a handful of compounds produced by the body, including some ketones, could be more effective than DEET as a natural mosquito repellent. The problem is I don't know squat about biochemistry, so I can't tell whether this kind of thing could really be attributed to paleo. Is there anything to my experience, or is it pseudoscience? Thanks, guys.
This one's kind of an interesting one, and here again, I wish I could share more about the project that I worked on, but I'll say this. I was exposed to both ketosis and bugs, and usually I am also the bug magnet, and although I definitely was pestered by mosquitoes a fair amount, like it was nothing like what it used to be in the past. So I've kind of had this experience also. There's not, Like you mentioned, there's not a ton on the internet. I looked on PubMed, kind of looking under some Google search terms like blood sugar, mosquitoes, attractant, and stuff like that. And there's not a lot of like good science out there. But there's tons of anecdotal information and then a little bit of fairly legit science that seems to indicate that mosquitoes definitely do hone in on folks with higher blood glucose levels. And so generally when you're in ketosis, we're partitioning blood for the brain, so we have relatively low blood glucose levels, higher ketone body levels, obviously. And kind of the primary fuel that mosquitoes run off of, they're not very lipid-driven. They're much more glucose-driven. So it makes sense that they're going to kind of hone in on high blood glucose levels. So that stuff all makes sense. Eating paleo in general, you know, it really depends on how you're going about it, whether or not you're going to be more in ketosis or not, with the caveat that if you are metabolically healthy, I think we generally run a little bit heavier, even if we're eating a higher carbohydrate intake. You know, you do like a Ketavan type diet that's maybe 50, 60% carbohydrate, but we're not metabolically impaired. We still have the ability to access body fat for energy, particularly between meals, probably have a little bit higher ketosis, you know, a ketogenic activity going on relative to a population that's metabolically challenged. So, I mean, this stuff all makes sense. There's a little bit of science out there that supports it, not a ton. There's a mountain of anecdotal stuff of people just talking about, hey, I'm a type 2, you know, I became type 1 diabetic. Bugs never used to bother me. Now they're all over me. What's the deal with this? And similar deals with type 2 diabetics, you know, just different forums, folks talking about this and how the type 2 diabetic individuals seem to be like the bug magnet in their group of friends. It's interesting for me, like as a kid and young adult, looking back now, I realize that probably because of some genetics, I've always been a little bit on the probably the insulin resistant side and had a tendency towards that. So it kind of makes sense that I definitely have always been kind of that bug magnet individual. So not a ton of science, a little bit of science, lots of anecdote, and kind of interesting, especially when you are the person that is getting chewed on all the time.
Yes, and it's probably good the less DEET you can rub all over yourself.
Indeed. Although, you know, it's funny. I worked in a supplement store one time, and this, seriously hippie family came in. I mean, like the mom, the dad, the kids, the dog all had dreadlocks, and they were like, we need the, you know, we can't use DEET. We're going to Lassen Park. We're going to camp in this one area. And I was like, dude, buy some DEET. Just take it with you for the love of God, because like I had backpacked in this area, and it other than like one or two places that I've been in Central America or in like Montana, there's some spots in Lassen Park that you can't hardly see. The mosquitoes are so thick. And this guy was like, no, I'm not going to buy that stuff. It's supporting the man. It's Monsanto and this and that. And I'm like, okay, dude, whatever. And so like they got some of the, you know, the natural insect repellent. And these folks were back the following morning, and then they needed like 8 bottles of calamine lotion because to a person, like they had like welts on top of their welts on top of their welts. And so, I don't know, whenever I think about the mosquito deal and the cost benefit trade-off of DEET, it's definitely not great stuff, but, relative to being awake all night and being eaten alive, or if you're in some area where there's actually like some West Nile or like malaria or something, I'll let my liver deal with the DEET and not get eaten alive. But that remembering always tickles me pretty good, just because I love hippies.
Yeah. All right. Matt said, Robin Gregg. I'm not, there's no segues today. We're just going to go.
It's just all working together. You didn't even put chapter titles on this stuff.
Yeah. I'm a bit behind this week. I'm an ardent listener of the podcast and really enjoy and appreciate all the information you give out for free. I follow pretty strict paleo plus dairy after reintroducing it with no issues, and usually directly post workout and CrossFit 4 to 5 times a week. Otherwise, I'm working a typical office job. But I find that no matter how much I eat, I rarely feel full. Have I just got my quantities wrong? When I look at it on a plate, it looks like I'm eating about the right amount. Before I went paleo, I was eating for mass slash energy to play rugby, and I had the same problems of not being full despite 4 to 5 large meals that included a fair amount of carbs from grains, potatoes, etc. A typical day's food will look something like this. Breakfast, 3 eggs cooked in grass-fed ghee, 1 large banana, handful of nuts, fish oil. Lunch, large salad, leaves, tomatoes, peppers, etc., about 5 to 7 ounces of meat or fish, 2 to 3 tablespoons of olive oil, apple. Dinner, a large piece of meat or fish cooked in ghee, vegetable with butter, occasional squash or sweet potato, approximately 3 times a week, and nuts. During the day, I'll snack on nuts, about 200 grams plus per day, fruit, raw vegetables, etc. And whenever I work out, I drink 25 ounces of full-fat, unhomogenized milk immediately afterwards. If I'm at home, I'll also be eating spoonfuls of extra thick cream straight out of the tub just to try and fill the gap. I'm 23 years old, 6'2", 85 kilos, and about 8-9% body fat. My question is, A, am I simply not eating enough? And B, what can I do to not feel so hungry between meals? There's only so many nuts one man can face eating in a day. Thanks in advance and keep up the good work.
Well, you know, taking a peek at this, it seems skinny to me. Like, I'm assuming
I would weigh 12 pounds if I ate that.
Yeah, I never eat only 3 eggs for breakfast. Like, I'm more like a 4 to 5 eggs than 3 to 4 pieces of bacon. I typically my larger whacks of carbs are post-workout. So, like, I'm usually not having a banana with breakfast and stuff like that. But otherwise, I am definitely eating more than this, and I'm weighing, 165, 170 pounds, something like that. So just shooting from the hip, I'd say you're probably under-eating, even when we're considering the snacking and eating, 200 grams of nuts per day. I would just say up all of your quantities. Generally, one thing in this, and we've talked about it a lot in the podcast, if you're feeling hungry, there's a potential for under-eating, but I think for a lot of people, like, too much carbohydrate, it's not as satiating as protein and fat. So you up the protein and fat at most meals, save the carbohydrates for mainly post-workout and, post-workout period. So, like, it's not ideal, but, like, for me, I've been forced to kind of train in the afternoon. So I usually start training about 3:30, wrap up about 4, 5-ish, something like that. 4:30 or 5, and then I do my post-workout carb meal and do a little bit more carbs after that if I had a really good burner, which it's not ideal for me, but it works pretty well. But I'm definitely not hungry at all through the rest of the day. So I would say eat more, partition carbs post-workout, and that's pretty much it. Anything you can think of?
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like he's getting plenty of fat with all the snacking and stuff, but that's the one thing that stood out is, one, just not enough food overall, but two, like, the protein is pretty low.
Yeah.
I mean, 3 eggs in a meal, that's like 15, 20 grams of protein, maybe. That's nothing. You know what I mean? Like, I can lick that off my lips right now. So, and then, 5 to 7 ounces of meat or fish, that's better, but maybe do, like, 2 of those.
Yeah.
And then dinner, same thing. So, I mean, 6'2 and 85 kilos, 187 pounds, that's pretty thin. I mean, yeah, that's a little bit wispy. So I would definitely say, and so at 23 years old, you and 8-9% body fat, you're probably burning pretty hot. So I would just be throwing a lot more protein in there and just more food overall, for sure.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And if the body fat creeps up to 10-11%, I wouldn't freak out about that. Probably have better androgen levels there anyway. So, which again, you're 23, so that's not a huge issue, but definitely more food, partition some carbs. You should be good to go with that.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Jennifer says, Rob, I'm a 51-year-old female who has recently begun the paleo journey. I'm 5'1" and on May 20th had a starting weight of 141 pounds and a number of health concerns. I was diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 40s with an overall DEXA scan of -3. It was a surprise to me and the medical staff as well at such a young age. Early treatment began with calcium supplements and oral meds, Fosamax, then Boniva, etc., which made me so sick with severe stomach pain that I had to be taken off the meds immediately. For the next 2 years, I took daily injections in my stomach of a medication called Forteo, restricted to 2 years of use. Oh, that makes you feel confident.
Seriously?
My DEXA scans were increasingly better, but over the last few years began to decline somewhat. Next treatment and current treatment as well is an annual infusion of Reclast. Additionally, I have suffered from migraine headaches since childhood, and over the past year or so have undergone weeks of physical therapy for chronic joint pain, back pain, and swelling of my hands and feet, and oddly enough, some neuropathy as well. Most recently, I've been tested for a number of autoimmune diseases to include MS, lupus, RA, and Lyme disease due to horrible skin rash on my left shin, joint pain, and fatigue. After 3 months on steroids and 4 weeks on antibiotics, the rash finally subsided. P.S. None of the testing revealed anything definitive. Today is July 19th, and I'm happy to report that my current weight is 126 pounds, and I feel better than I have in years. No swelling or joint pain and no migraines since about week two of going paleo. My question and concern is about my continued osteoporosis treatment and your opinion about Reclast, or if you feel my bones can actually heal and become strong as a result of the paleo way. My last Reclast infusion was in December 2010, and I started paleo in May 2011. Supplements include Carlson's fish oil, and I have ordered Natural Calm and will begin taking that on a regular basis. Do you have any recommendations for the treatment of osteoporosis? Your advice is valued and much appreciated.
Gosh, a lot of stuff going on here, but you know, whenever I see migraines, this kind of systemic inflammatory stuff, you know, it's interesting. Used to, in my head, I had the issues of metabolic derangement completely separate from autoimmune disease. But we now have a pretty good understanding that systemic inflammation underlies both of these conditions. And really, if you think about the immune response, we have the innate immune response on the one hand, which is kind of somewhat dumb, unadaptive, you know, it's macrophages and whatnot. And dumb is just painting it in comparison to the adaptive immune system, which produces antibodies and whatnot. All of this is a spectrum of our immune response. And if we have inflammation, it can upregulate the immune response across the board. And this manifests in anything from metabolic derangement, you know, insulin sensitivity, to autoimmune disease, to systemic inflammation. Like it just kind of runs the gamut. And so what we have here, it's kind of interesting. This is where, you know, the wheels start falling off the wagon for folks, where she's getting tested for MS and lupus and Lyme disease. You've got some diffuse pain throughout the body. There's a migraine headaches, which we know are related to insulin resistance and kind of blood sugar crashes and stuff like that. So we've got a bunch of different problems going on here. Additionally, we've got this issue of osteoporosis, which if we do a little bit of digging on the osteoporotic process, the main issue with that typically is some sort of insulin resistance coupled with elevated cortisol levels, which is very, very antagonistic to bone growth. It basically starts bleeding calcium out of the body. And this is really, I think, the main vector of where we find osteoporosis brewing. It is basically an insulin resistance, an inflammation, and an elevated cortisol levels. And if we reverse all that stuff, we should be able to reverse the signs and symptoms of osteoporosis. So where I would be with this, I would make sure that my vitamin D levels are good, somewhere around like 60 nanograms per milliliter. You may need to supplement with that. If you can get a lot of sun, that's good, you know, however you go with that. And then from there, kind of a lowish carb, doesn't have to be super low, but a little bit on the low side, paleo-type diet, and some really good resistance training. Back squat, deadlift, press, push press, bench, pull-ups, you know, I mean, just get strong. The main focus that you want to do is basically kind of like bodybuilding or powerlifting type stuff, because you want to build bone mineral density via getting stronger muscles, which are increasing the loading that you're putting across the long bones. Basically, the more that we flex and torque on these long bones, the thicker and more robust they become. And so walking is okay for some of the, you know, like the spinal column and stuff like that, but we need some really vigorous loading to rebuild bone mineral density, particularly in the hips and in the long bones, the hip articulation, the femur articulation, and all that stuff. So what you do with this is you get on a smart strength and conditioning program, you eat paleo, you get your sleep dialed in, you know, all the standard stuff. You sleep in a pitch black room, you do all the cortisol and autoimmune protocols that are either for free on the website or found in the book, and then you check in with your doctor And it, as to whether or not you use the reclast, I would just check in with your doc and see if he or she is game for you doing a lifestyle modification experiment to see if you can get better, as good or better results without the reclast as with it. And what you do is you give it a 6-month run, and you go lowish carb paleo, get your sleep dialed, lift some weights, check before you start this protocol, check after you start this protocol, and see where you're at. And then also it's nice that you have all of these earlier DEXA scans so that you can use those as previous baselines as well. And then it basically just plays out to do we see improvement? And I would be shocked if you didn't see improvement by doing this. But if you don't, then you've got the reclast as kind of a fallback deal. But I think it's completely reasonable to reverse these signs and symptoms of the osteoporosis. It's just going to be kind of an integrated approach to do it.
That seems to be the biggest component that people either ignore or don't understand, is that bone is living tissue. Like, people tend to think of it like it's a chunk of cement that's getting worn away or something. So the only option is like some kind of weird drug infusion into your stomach.
Yeah, and you know, it's an unfortunate thing. When you dig around in the literature, because folks are typically looking at sedentary, metabolically deranged people, then it's just kind of an if A, then B kind of extension that people lose bone density over time as they age. Similarly, you know, it's kind of an if A, then B deal that we lose muscle mass as we age. And we definitely do lose muscle mass to some degree, but we find in very active populations and hunter-gatherer populations that sarcopenia and osteoporosis, osteopenia, is not a normal condition, and it does not progress anywhere near the rates that we see in westernized populations. So our medical community is a little bit blinded in this, because our normal population is assumed, you know, normal is taken to be who is walking through the door. It's not looking back and looking at a baseline. You know, what's really healthy should be the basis of normal. And in fact, virtually nobody is healthy at this point. So we assume that there's no fixative other than a pharmaceutical intervention, and it's completely wrong. And when we look at this stuff with like Fosamax and Boniva and some of this stuff, it's funny. It will improve a DEXA scan. You know, it'll make the bones thicker, but it doesn't prevent fracture. It may actually increase fracture rate, because what this stuff does is it kind of aggregates microcrystalline hydroxyapatite, I think it's what the actual bone matrix is made of. But a really important element of that is the scaffolding, almost like rebar made out of protein. But the way that the Boniva and the Fosamax work, they don't really work synergistically with that rebar element of the reinforcing proteins. It just aggregates calcium in there. And I think somewhere maybe 3 years ago I did a pretty lengthy blog post on this. And so what we find when we really look at the outcomes, like the purpose behind all this stuff, like why do we care about osteoporosis at all? We care because if somebody falls, they break a hip, and potentially they die from that. They die due to complications, breaking a hip, breaking an arm, something like that, because the bones are weaker. So we want thicker, stronger bones. But in fact, when we look at the outcomes with like Boniva and Fosamax, the bones may become thicker, but they're not actually any stronger. It may actually be more brittle than not doing any intervention at all. So awesome. It's kind of like, yeah, and then you've got a plethora of side effects with it, and we completely ignore the fact that a change in nutrition and lifestyle, especially reversing metabolic derangement, reversing inflammation, and getting people lifting weights like 2 days a week, like doing a full body circuit routine two days a week, is plenty to rebuild both muscle mass and bone density and dramatically improve health and lifestyle outcomes. And I mean, it's a, you know, a 30-minute full body circuit done on Monday and Thursday is enough to, you know, for like a 50 to 80 year old population to have great health outcomes, great muscle mass, good bone mineral density, if we're taking care of these other elements. And we're talking about an hour a week of exercise, you know, in the gym, and then hopefully the rest of the time is spent being active and doing some other stuff, because we definitely need more activity than that to really be as healthy as we could be. But it's minimal interventions, and we're just not educating people on this stuff.
That's correct.
And apparently I've perked up a little bit because I'm jabbering like a wild man now. So
that's okay. That's what people pay you for.
Indeed. Indeed.
All right. Michael says, hi, Rob and Greg. Hello from England. I've been paleo for about 18 months. Totally get it. And I'm grateful for your work. I'm slowly but surely convincing my wife that this is how we should both be eating. We were expecting our first child in October 2011 and are starting to discuss how we will feed him or her after breastfeeding. Whilst my wife agrees that our child will likely be better off eating meat and vegetables, she's concerned that cutting grains out completely will cause problems. Given that our child is unlikely to avoid grains for for its whole life, we would not want it to experience a potentially dangerous overreaction when he or she shares pizza with friends years from now. What do you think? Could excluding grains lead to intolerance? Could it be a good idea to include some grains in a child's diet to build up resistance? Many thanks.
Well, God, this one, I don't know why, and I'm really not being a dick, really not trying to attack folks. I don't know why this one just gets my goat, you know, the kid deal. And the thing is that you don't build up a resistance to this stuff. I don't know how to explain that to people any more clearly. Like it's in the book. It's I've written about it a ton on the blog. I've talked about it on the podcast. And like I said, it causes me to almost go fetal on this thing. You've got a window of time with the kids, and this is pretty well understood. Fasano's work on gluten resistance and gluten intolerance and autoimmune diseases. If you keep a kid gluten and dairy free up until the age of 5, you decrease their likelihood of developing type 1 diabetes by about 80%. So what you are actually doing is allowing the child's gastrointestinal tract to actually develop and become as robust as it can be by avoiding the grains, legumes, and dairy. And additionally, you're saving yourself and the kid a mountain of suffering, because what we see again and again and again is that people, you know, maybe the mom ate paleo during the pregnancy and she did pretty good, and then they go from breastfeeding to weaning, and then they start introducing things like cream of rice and cream of wheat, and the kid starts getting GI problems, and they start getting wacky poops, they start getting colicky, but everybody assumes that this is normal because all kids end up having this. But it's only, you know, we're slowly getting a bigger pool of people that are actually feeding their kids this way, and we just don't see any of these GI problems. If you check out Everyday Paleo, if you check out Growing Up Paleo, you've got two moms with 4 kids between the lot of them. There's a bunch of other people out there with their kids, and they're feeding them all paleo. These kids are doing shockingly well. Like my nephew Caden is like the 99th percentile on everything except his body weight. Like his height, his developmental capacity, everything is off the charts except the fact that he's lean and not fat for his height and his weight and age and all the rest of that stuff. So that's the only thing missing with this. The concern about whether or not the kid is going to have some mega overreaction down the road, they will probably have a reaction if they have pizza when they're 5. But the thing is that they're probably in a spot then where they probably will not develop type 1 diabetes. But the thing is, this is something that folks have to get. It's a game of roulette to some degree, Russian roulette here, in that any time you introduce some sort of a gut irritant to a human being or any type of organism, you've got a potential for problems to arise. So, that said, you know, like with Caden, we'll give him some corn chips once in a while and stuff like that. We just kind of see how he does, and he doesn't seem to have any GI problems with it. And so every once in a while, we're out at Mexican food, and he'll get some corn chips. Anytime he's had any type of a gluten exposure, and it's always been accidental up till this point, he has serious gastrointestinal problems, like for a couple of days. And exposing him to that every day would cause him to have a level of inflammation in the gastrointestinal tract that I guess we could call resistance to some degree, but then the kid is at a base level of being sick and compromised all the time. So I kind of make this a little bit analogous to, you know, at some point your kids may go out and have cocaine and heroin.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, you know, because that's where the good life is. So do you give them the cocaine and heroin as kids so that they build up a resistance to it?
That's a trick question.
Greg's like, I may have extra kids, so I can dig into the stash. I mean, that's maybe getting a little bit wild or far afield, but we haven't had kids yet. We're looking forward to having kids. All I can tell you is from my perspective, you have this shocking opportunity to grow up your kids in a way that we didn't have the benefit. We didn't have the opportunity. I didn't have the opportunity of being raised largely grain-free, which would have probably dramatically improved my health as a kid. Just shockingly. So what I'm saying to you guys is that when you have your kids, you've got an opportunity to do right by them in a way that was never an opportunity for us, our generation, because our parents just simply didn't know about this. We didn't have this information at hand. So you fly the, you know, drive the boat however you want to with your kid. Like I always say with this, I'm not trying to turn it into religion, not trying to make it some sort of orthodox paleoite kind of gig. But when the kids come into play, I get a little bit more protective and I draw a little bit more sturdy of a line in the sand because they don't have a say in the matter. They don't know any better yet. And you as parents do. You have an opportunity to allow your kids to grow up and be healthier in a way that most people don't understand currently. And what I'm imploring upon you is that your kids will be better off without the grains, without the legumes, generally without the dairy. If you want to throw in some grass-fed butter on their veggies, fine. If they have any types of signs and symptoms, GI distress or autoimmune type things going on, then ditch that stuff. And that's just kind of my whole deal. Once the kids become older, you know, they're 10, 12, something like that, they're certainly not adults, but I think they're certainly old enough to make their own decisions, and they're going to start hanging out with friends and going out and doing whatever, then you teach them these wacky life skills of consequences. You do something, and there's consequences associated with it. You explain to them that there may be foods that may not make them feel good and may have some health consequences associated with it. And you start teaching them value systems based around consequences. And it starts with food, and then they're not neurotic about their food, but they understand that eating certain things may have untoward effects on their health. And then they make decisions about whether or not that's a viable cost-benefit decision for them. And they start growing up and being actual, like, whole human beings instead of, you know, not being able to make decisions on their own. But they've got a protective period of time that I think we as parents, I don't want to get too moralized about this, but I think you have a really big opportunity to do good by your kids, and I guess I'll leave it at that. But you're definitely not going to do better by them giving them grains, legumes, and dairy earlier. I am absolutely sold on that. I've written a ton about it. There's plenty of other information related to it, so I guess that's my shtick on it.
Sounds good.
Greg's like, for the love of God, shut up, Rob.
Yeah, when you said you were tired, I was hoping you'd have quick answers.
Apparently not.
That's cool. You're easily wound up.
Yeah.
All right. Bricia says, first, I want to thank Rob, though it might sound like I'm exaggerating. I want to thank him for giving me my life back. Why'd you take her life, Rob?
Well, I'm kind of a vampire in a way.
Long story short, or as short as I can make it without putting you and Andy asleep, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia at age 19 in 2001, but doctors suspect I've been suffering symptoms from as early as 14. In a time pre-Cymbalta, Lyrica, and all those other wonderful cocktail crap drugs, I was told there, aside from stuffing myself with pills, there was little I could do. I think she meant that. This sent me into a depression, downward spiral. I became a hermit, lost friendships, severed family ties, and alienated myself from anyone who didn't understand. I was a 19-year-old trapped in the body of a crippled, bitter 90-year-old. Fast forward 2011, almost a decade later, and I find the paleo solution. I'm 3 months in, and I've never felt better. I'm more energetic, bouncy, and happy than I ever was at 19, and everyone around me has noticed. I finally feel like myself. The inside matches the outside at last. I've tried reintroducing certain items into the diet, legumes, tubers, but found that as soon as I do, the joint pain comes back. Weak, but it's there. I then found Podcast 48, love, love, love the podcast, by the way, and heard you talk about fibro, and it seems to me that for fibro peeps, it is better off to stay paleo 100%. So finally, the CrossFit question, how to start. I've been doing some small stuff at home like air squats, burpees, etc., but I want to join my local CrossFit center. What should I tell the trainers? I just don't want to set myself back by taking up on exercises my body might flare up on. Suggestions, ideas, other info. Age 28, 5'3", highest weight 163, yuck. Lowest weight 110 from starving. Current weight on paleo, a slender and firm 123. And then there's a big smiley face. And again, thank you. XOXOXO, winking smiley face.
And, well, Greg and I both enjoy 5'3", 123, and firm. That's all going in the right direction. So, you know, just the question was about the CrossFit deal, but just this links right back into, I think, our first question where, you know, obviously some signs and symptoms of systemic inflammation. This sounds really, really similar to what I had going on before going paleo and reversing all the gastrointestinal problems that I had. Not surprising at all that the legumes and tubers might be problematic. And this, again, is why I'm a little bit of a nutcase on if people want to give this stuff a shot, you really go full bore for 30 days, grains, legume, dairy-free. If you got signs and symptoms of systemic inflammation and autoimmunity, do the autoimmune protocol additionally. We cut out nuts and seeds, except for coconut, perhaps. Tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, peel any type of peels off of your tubers, maybe even avoid tubers completely. And the game plan with that is try to get people healthy and then they can reintroduce and tinker. And so it sounds like this is exactly what she did. She got healthy and then has reintroduced certain items and just kind of, you know, system checks to see how it goes. And she gets a little bit of inflammation. And then for her, I think it's kind of a question of, okay, I know if I have a sweet potato, I may be a little bit creaky for a couple of days, but I really want to have one because I'm hanging out with family and my mom makes this awesome sweet potato dealio. And so you do it, but you understand some of the cost benefit there. But it's an informed decision on that stuff. So the CrossFit question, you know, this is a... The CrossFit scene is really, really, really unfortunate, in my opinion. And
that's a good way to put it.
And it is because, you know, the big falling out that we had really was an outgrowth of the fact that I was pushing this paleo plus CrossFit kind of concept. But very early on, I started pushing for a moderated volume and intensity approach on the CrossFit deal. Like, early in the very beginning of CrossFit, it was mainly couplets and triplets, and it was pretty smart programming relative to what we see today, but then they decided to go down this path of elite athletics. It's funny, a bunch of the arguments that I had with Greg Glassman and with boners like Tony Budding and stuff like that, people really don't have a scientific background in any of this stuff. I was relaying to them that out of CrossFit facilities that had adopted paleo, we were seeing things like the reversal of Huntington's disease, which ended up spawning a UCLA-UCSD study related to Huntington's disease and gluten-free diets and paleo, which is actually going to be getting underway here pretty soon. We saw just tons and tons of reversal of multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis and all this sort of stuff. And for whatever reason, instead of adopting this health orientation into the system, they booted us because they didn't understand the technology. They always need to be the one with the upper hand and the final answer and all the rest of that. And if they're not the authority on a topic, then they've got to kick the authority out so that they can appear to be the authority. But the opportunity that was lost for CrossFit was that they drove the boat towards elite athletics, theoretically, in the form of CrossFit Games competition, which I'll tip my hat to the people competing at this point. Like, they're beasts, but they're typically beasts that were really good athletes in other arenas and then walk on to the CrossFit scene and kick everybody's ass, which is exactly what we've been talking about from the beginning with all that stuff. But the problem here is that the culture has focused around elite and volume and intensity and beatdown, and there's very, very little directive towards ramp up or progression or anything like that. You know, like, my wife wrote the on-ramp program. We've written numerous articles about the importance of progression and instead of scaling. The first time that you walk into a gym, you should not be exposed to the deadlift via a Diane workout, 21-15-9 deadlift handstand pushup, giving the person a piece of PVC and saying, well, we're going to scale it because we're a beginner, is horseshit. It's fucking stupid. You need to be exposed to complex motor patterns in a dedicated progressive way. So you don't start people with the deadlift in a metabolic program. You just flat don't do it. So the problem here that arises, there are tons and tons of CrossFit facilities. Lots of them are actually advocating paleo at this point. Like the paleo versus zone discussion has been pretty well met and the zone lost. Paleo won. Done. But then the question still arises, do these facilities have a beginner's program? Whether they call it on-ramp or elements or whatever, do they have a dedicated beginner's program? Do they understand the difference between progression and scaling? Do they understand or have the capacity to offer personal training where appropriate? So do they have a screening program? When somebody comes through the door and they're like, you know what, you've had a bunch of fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue and stuff like that, I recommend that you either do personal training or small group training for a month to 2 months till we get you ramped up and we see how you respond to volume and intensity, and then we can think about introducing you to our elements class and eventually you can graduate into level one. Does the facility offer all that stuff? If they don't, then it's a problem. And you know, the funny thing is it's not just a problem for the clients, it's a problem for the facility, because I'll guarantee you the facility would make more money if they had all of that infrastructure in place. But everybody that was talking about that infrastructure has been kicked out of CrossFit, so, you know, where the hell is that information coming from? Well, it's still coming from somewhere, it's just not coming from the HQ, the powers that be. And for them, that's a really big problem when the best information related to training and progression and all the rest of that comes from entities other than the governing body. Because then the governing body is no longer the power seat. They're no longer the place that people look to for information. So that's all a bunch of like political backstory and other bullshit that I probably shouldn't get into. But the long and short of this is I don't know if it's okay for you to go to your local CrossFit facility. And that's a crying shame. There should have been some sort of QAQC, quality control, quality assurance, such that I could easily, with no reservation, say, you should absolutely go check that place out, and they'll be able to take care of you, because I know they've got some sort of a beginner's class, they've got some sort of a screening program, and I'm virtually certain that you're going to go in there and not get broken, because you're entering the game with some pre-existing conditions that absolutely leave you open to things like rhabdo and other really serious problems, to say nothing of elevated cortisol problems from overtraining. So that's really, and this is sincere. Like, obviously, I've got a bunch of fairly angry feelings at the CrossFit HQ scene, but it's a failing on their part that we don't have a network of gyms, that we have at some level of assurance that almost anybody, medical professional or otherwise, could refer people to them and to know that it's going to be a safe, enjoyable experience. And we absolutely cannot do that. And that's unfortunate, because there's a bunch of people out there doing this stuff, and I'm sure that they've generally got good intentions. And if they had been given better skills, if people had been kept in the community to provide better skills to these people, we would have a better product offer across the board and we could help a lot more people. But we don't give a shit about that. What we give a shit about is some perceived elitism, and we could give a fuck about helping people that have conditions like this, even though something that looks somewhat like CrossFit plus a paleo program and the community and lifestyle and all that stuff can save lives. But we could give a fuck about saving lives when we got the CrossFit games and all the rest of that stuff.
Well, I mean, the main problem is that Bricia is just a weak performer.
So we don't give a fuck about weak performers. Yeah, yeah, she's not elite enough.
If you can't come in and do Murph on day one, then, you know, we just don't have a use for you. In all honesty, I actually did get an email through Rob's site to asking me to stop being so diplomatic about my answers about CrossFit, but I'm going to continue being diplomatic because I'm trying on this new, like, mature, wise, whatever bullshit. But and plus, it's more fun to listen to Rob do it. But in all honesty, you can try a local CrossFit center, but make sure it's one that doesn't actually do CrossFit. Well, and I know that sounds facetious, but I'm being dead serious. We were a CrossFit affiliate for a couple of years, and we didn't really do CrossFit, despite what, you know, Greg Glassman and T. Puddin would have you believe. You know, just because there were back squats and push-ups doesn't mean it's CrossFit. So, like Rob said, find people who are actually qualified and experienced and weren't just delivering pizzas 2 weeks ago. And, you know, all CrossFit affiliate means is that you have a valid credit card. And that's, and you that's really what it comes down to.
At one point, that meant that you maybe didn't even attend a seminar. At this point, I believe that you have to be at least level one anointed, but at one point it didn't even mean that you had even shown up at a seminar yet.
Well, level one is just an indoctrination. It's not any kind of certification.
Right. So. Right. You know, the long and short of it is go meet the people, ask them, do you have a beginner's program? If they don't, ask them why they don't. Do you offer personal training? If they don't, ask them why they do not. And then ask them, have you heard of the on-ramp curriculum written by Nikki Violetti, not by folks who have plagiarized it and then published it in the CrossFit Journal? They even plagiarized the incorrect mathematical notation that we've been using. So, and someday we may actually do something about that.
Amateurs.
Jesus, man. Yeah,
but you know, honestly, go in there and tell them exactly what your situation is. Like, hey, I have fibromyalgia, blah blah blah. And if they give you a blank stare, then it's a pretty good bet they have no idea how to handle you.
Yeah, and just keep looking. Just keep looking from that point. The Ruttman's like max effort black box programming is really, really good stuff. There are some other folks out there. Like, I think Invictus posts some of their programming. The Catalyst Watt is great, but you know, it's
probably
obviously
not
very, very lifting oriented, so maybe not appropriate. But there is some good stuff floating around out there. But I would just kind of knock on doors and ask them some questions and see what type of trainer, what type of coach they are, and if it sniffs pretty good, then give it a shot. And that said, like, if people will take this general idea of functional movements and appropriate intensity and progression and ramp up and everything, I think it could be amazing for you. If they throw you into the mix and just assume that you're going to do 20 to 40 minute chipper, and they're just going to scale it for you, and that's your day one workout, then we've got a huge problem there. It's going to set you back.
Yeah, and in all honesty, personal training is obviously very expensive, and it's tough for anyone to afford that 3 to 5 days a week. But if you can find someone who will work with you one-on-one, even once a week, but then write a program for you for a few other days outside of that gym, you know, something you can do at home, and like Rob said, have some kind of, especially at this point, very basic, straightforward progression, learning these movements and then practicing the movements and then training the movements, you know, after a little bit of that, then, you know, and seeing how you respond to it, you probably will be okay to go into classes, at least that are programmed intelligently and implemented well, not just, you know, if the gym posts the CrossFit.com workout, that's their workout, then
keep walking.
Yeah, just get as far away from there as possible.
James Sachero got himself in hot water at one of his talks by basically just saying, I don't think that the .com, you know, WOD is appropriate for most people.
I wouldn't let anyone do that.
I wouldn't either, but he was being diplomatic enough to just say most people, you know, with the caveat in there that maybe you've got some monstrous freak of nature that's going to come in and dominate that stuff. And I think that that's a very honest assessment. And yet again, you provide an honest assessment, and instead of either having dialogue or discussion on the topic, you just kick the person out. So another one of our best, you know, coaches and brightest minds in this functional fitness scene, they get ousted for basically saying, I don't really like the .com programming, and I think it's inappropriate for most people, particularly beginners.
Well, they say right there, though, I mean, it's admittedly, what's their line? The CrossFit.com workout of the day is meant to exceed the capacity of the world's fittest people. So they've said right there, it's appropriate for no one. Like, but, it doesn't make any sense.
But And I guess when you agree with them on that, then you get kicked out.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, yeah, jump in on this workout, but no, it's harder than you could or anyone could handle.
You do get to have it both ways when you run some sort of an Orwellian kind of gig where you just keep changing the story to suit your needs.
That's not
so
what
you can
I said.
Always be right.
All right. Well,
yeah, enough on that to some degree, but you know, obviously I've got a lot of emotion on this, but a lot of it, and it's not just, you know, that I got booted out of CrossFit and shit like that. Like legit, you know, I legitimately want to help people, and there was a huge opportunity lost by CrossFit HQ turning its back on the health and longevity potentiality of this. Just a huge opportunity lost. And it will likely never be remet at all in general. Definitely not under their banner. There may be some other opportunities to kind of unite that idea at some point down the road, but you know, it's just a huge opportunity loss. It could have helped a lot of people, and it would not have diminished the ability to push the CrossFit Games, the Elite Athletics, or any of that stuff at all. Would have actually lended more credibility to it to be able to say, hey, we can modify this stuff for a ton of different situations, and I'm not just talking about scaling. You know, it goes way beyond scaling.
Well, now that we've entered the Rabakian era, it's certainly a lost cause.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, moving on.
Somewhat.
Well, you know, one of these days what we have to do is record a full-length podcast just on CrossFit and then not publish it.
That would be fun. It would almost be like the breakup letter that you don't send or something
exactly.
Like that. Yeah, totally, totally. That would be hilarious.
Although,
no, what we do with that one is we make it a paid download.
I was just
going to
say I would sell it on the side. So.
We make that one a paid download, and it's like $50. Like you got to really want to listen to that one.
Yeah. All right. Teridu says, and I guarantee I'm mispronouncing your name, so I apologize. Hey, Rob and Greg, I would like to hear your thoughts regarding a weight set point. I'm male, 44, 5'8", 207 pounds, and have been paleo for about 2 years. I'm dealing with some cortisol issues and adrenal fatigue and have been having an impossible time losing weight. That said, I don't ever seem to go above 207. Even after falling off the wagon, i.e. a week in Paris, the weight doesn't seem to budge either way. Someone was trying to explain to me that this is just the weight my body wants to be at, and that's that. Please tell me that's not true. How do I tell my body that it really wants to be 180 pounds? I eat very clean, around 2,000 calories a day, and have been very low carb, but I'm trying to up my carb intake to around 100 to 150 grams a day. I get 2 strength training sessions in a week, and the other 5 days try to walk for an hour, do yoga, or some such low-stress exercise. Thanks.
You know, the set point deal, I don't know how much like science there is on it, but there's science. But there's a lot of anecdotal stuff out there. Martin over at Lean Gains has written some really good stuff on the set point deal, and Greg and I have kind of talked about this. Like Martin's usually looking at it from a standpoint of trying to ramp people down to a lower body weight and get them lean, really not so much body weight, but to an increased level of leanness. Greg and I have talked about this in regards to trying to bring people up to, say, like a heavier weight class in O-lifting or powerlifting or something. And usually the best way that you do that is this stepwise approach where, say, like you make a 5 or a 10-pound change, maybe a 5% body weight change or something, and then maintain that for 4 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, 12 weeks or whatever, then make another push. But, my gut sense on this is that the body definitely has some sort of a set point, and it takes significant work to undo that. I did this mass gain deal a couple of years ago. It was a horrible idea. I had high cortisol. I had low androgen levels. Like the results were horrible. And I've always been...
Yeah, but you were jacked.
Yeah. Like jacked in the box. You know, I was a doughy turd. And the funny thing is that before that, I was always like the really lean, pretty muscular, but like if whatever else went sideways, I was always lean. I always had like a 12-pack kind of thing going on. I was always really lean. And so in addition to all the stress, all the cortisol, and then the big food intake and the big dairy intake, which the dairy ends up kind of exacerbating that metabolic derangement, I got fat, and like mainly insulin-resistant fat. And then after that, I tried leaning out, and man, it just wouldn't happen. And it was interesting, like that insulin-resistant fat around the waistline, I feel like was kind of feeding into additional cortisol problems. We definitely know that different fat located around the body can cause some different signaling with regards to leptin and ghrelin and stuff like that. And dude, I had a hell of a time. And then this project that I did, I ended up losing 16 pounds in like 8 days. I basically like starved, which isn't great. But the interesting deal with that, the insulin-resistant fat, gone. Like my love handle dealio is just done. And it's really interesting, like androgen levels seem to be better. I'm actually getting some confirmational blood work on that. Everything seems better. My sleep is better, the whole deal. I, you know, I'm slowly adding some muscle mass back up and all that sort of stuff, but I'm not gaining body fat right around the waistline. And so it is interesting that I think there is something to the set point, and really what you've got to do, like if you want to be leaner, you've got to figure out, okay, what is it that's going on in your life with the stress? You got to get a handle on that. Like, you just have to get a handle on it. And then you may need to do some sort of fairly vigorous calorie restriction. And, you know, tweaking things, if you've got some adrenal stuff going on, doing the 100 to 150 grams of carbs a day is probably a good idea, particularly post-workout. Play with that and see how you respond to it. Hopefully we see some amelioration in the cortisol issues. If we just see you getting fat, then obviously we need to shift gears. But you might need to do some somewhat uncomfortable calorie restriction for a period of time. And, you know, if you're at 207 pounds, stair-step yourself down to about 200 or maybe 197, and then maintain that for a period of time, like eight weeks, and then do another stair-step down and then maintain that. It's going to take some work, and the work's going to have to address the adrenal issues, but it's also going to have to address, to some degree, the set point kind of gig. And, you know, Gary Tobbs talks a ton about this stuff in Good Calories, Bad Calories. The information is definitely out there on the set point. You can change it, but it takes some pretty serious work.
Cool.
Sweet. Thanks, Jeith. Let's see, anything new brewing with you? Do you have a seminar coming up anytime soon? Or
thankfully, no.
Okay.
So I finally have a little bit of a break now. We don't have another real big meet till December. And I don't have another seminar till January. So I get to catch up on all the projects I have on the back burner here. So hopefully before December, we have a couple new products coming out.
Nice. And, right on.
But I'm not going to talk about those because I can't guarantee they'll actually come out in that time frame.
Perfect. Cool.
So
let's see here. We've got the Ancestral Health Symposium popping up. I think this podcast is going to go up before, either immediately before or immediately after. We've got the final Paleo Solution Seminar that's going to occur in Boston. So if you want to get in on that action, after that, it's going to be a kind of medical professionals only kind of gig. Yeah, I think that's about all I got. I have for the moment. So thanks, man.
You bet.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Bye.